Today's program is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. For more information, visit mofad.org.
Hello there, Greenhorns. This is Severin, and this is Greenhorns Radio, radio for young farmers, by young farmers. And, of course, that means that we are talking about farming, and I am trying to find the name of my radio guest on my email, which is embarrassing, but that is the life that I am living. Come here, little friend. Don't run from me. Wait a minute. How about I just ask my guest? Hey, guest, who are you?
Hi, Mark Militzer. How are you doing?
Hi, Mark from Tree of Life. Are you in Iowa or are you in Wisconsin?
Southwest Wisconsin.
Southwest Wisconsin. It was so nice to meet you the other day at the Cincinnati Mound in the nunnery or the monastery or the sister house.
I think it's like a retirement home for sisters. Yeah, beautiful place.
Will you start off just introducing yourself and your farm operation and the region in which you live?
Okay. My name is Mark Militzer, and my farm is Tree of Life Gardens. I've been doing it for 7 years, and I love it. I love what I do for a living. It definitely is a lifestyle.
Do you want to describe a little bit your operation and kind of what the other local food scene is around you, or kind of young farmer scene, and what the conventional landscape of agriculture is in the areas around your farm?
Okay. We have a 5-acre vegetable farm here, and I rent between 2 and 7 or 10 acres down the road, depending on the year. We grow a lot of different stuff because we do a CSA, as well as I love to specialize in mushrooms. We've been getting into a lot of salad greens lately, too, and We take our stuff to farmers markets. I go all the way to Chicago area, Oak Park, Illinois, Rockford. So those two are about 1.5 to 3.5 hours away from my farm. We also sell locally in the Dubuque, Iowa area. That's right across the river. So that's like 20 minutes away. And we do a CSA and sell to local grocery stores, co-ops, restaurants, stuff like that. Surrounding me is basically industrial agriculture all around me, big corn and soybean fields. The people here locally don't know as much about eating organic or local as much as just price shopping at Walmart. But that's why I end up traveling so far, 3.5 hours away, to sell most of my vegetables. So far, it hasn't worked out in this area, but that's changing. We have a great extension service here, and Carolyn Grace is leading that and really breaking into the local foods movement and talking to all the institutions and everybody at the restaurants, trying to connect farmers to these places, figure out how we can put this all together. So, for the most part, I've been doing that. I've also sold to Organic Valley. They have a produce pool, and that's about 1.5 hours north of me. It's mostly Amish growers doing it all by hand. And we kind of broke in because we have a machine to harvest root crops, and so that kind of gives us an edge. So I've done some wholesaling to them, too, but it hasn't been as great as the retail sales, you know? So
I love it how you're able to get in on the Amish game because you have a root harvesting equipment.
Yeah. They're not cultivating with tractors or harvesting with equipment. So just having that stuff really helps us, get things done faster, that's for sure. you know?
Let's talk a little bit about land access, your own personal land access story, but also kind of what is the character of the land access drama in your neck of the woods? Like, what are the young farmers around you facing in terms of farmland prices? Who are you competing with? How are people managing to navigate?
Yeah. It is pretty darn difficult for somebody to get in to actually farming vegetables around here just because the land prices seem to be so expensive, you know. Right now, I mean, I've heard $10,000 an acre is like a normal thing to say. I've heard $14,000 or more in Iowa. You know, it's pretty cost prohibitive. That's why I'm renting down the road, and I have a small vegetable farm here. We just sort of like bumped into this. It was the cheapest farm we could find with buildings and a well at the time. And you know, like a lot of people are renting land, but there isn't a lot of vegetable farmers around here. It's pretty rare. I know of three other like substantial farms in my zone, you know, like 100-mile radius. Most of them are north of us. Like up in Viroqua, which is an hour and a half north of me, is really like the hub of vegetable farming of this area, full of Amish. And up there, it is way cheaper to buy land, like maybe 4,000 an acre or something. If you go to like poor area of Hillsboro. So that's where the hub is because that's where the land is cheap. And that's where Organic Valley is. So they all have a place to sell it. Or down where I'm at, it can be pretty difficult because difficult to sell vegetables. And then, yeah, expensive to even get in on it. I mean, you know, that's a pretty big mortgage when you're talking $10,000 an acre, you know. And it seems to me that you have to have quite a few acres of vegetables to be able to pull off paying the bills, you know?
Well, and I just come over from the Driftless and doing the video shoots for the Hourland agroforestry episode, and so I just spent a lot of time talking about geology with all the agroforestry peeps and them explaining to me how and why the history of that place, the geological history of the northern part of the Midwest, made it more cheaper land, more yep. family scale, more whoopie swoopy topography, and therefore really good habitats for the organic movement to proceed and for companies like Organic Valley to become established and crucial, and for the kinds of cooperation that they offer to be really appropriate to the needs of growers. Whereas you're closer flatland, closer to the empire of Monsanto export, and
right.
therefore higher land prices, larger farms, more consolidation, and higher prices.
Right, yeah. They have such small plots on the top of the hills or in the valleys up north of me. They really have to squeeze as much as they can out of these little pieces of land, and so I guess, yeah, vegetable farming makes sense more up there. We're here, it's just open field, you know, just spray it all. So, yeah, makes it a lot different.
Well, think about, you in answering the next couple questions, think about whatever stuff you want to make sure to get across, that you bend my question in order to get it across, because... One of the questions I had in your talk at the Cincinnati Mound, you were talking a lot about, you know, moving between scales and viability between scales, and, you know, having spent 7 years and saying things like lifestyle makes me want to ask you questions about farm viability and profitability.
Sure.
And maybe you want to talk about that, or maybe you want to talk about something else, and I'm going to let you do what you want.
Okay, cool. Well, yeah. I've been doing it for 7 years, and I've made a lot of mistakes, and I fell into it. You see, I was a glass blower, an artist, and I was in the permaculture and organics and all that. And so what I was looking for when we bought this piece of land was just a place to do permaculture and live more of a homestead lifestyle. And what occurred was I realized more and more how bad for my health glass blowing was. When you are using these colors have heavy metals, and these metals like atomize into the air, and you just cannot help but absorb heavy metals. And I was starting to get sick from it. And so what I did was I got way more into gardening, and about the same time, serendipity happened. They said there was a recession going on. And overnight, it was like people stopped buying $120 marbles from me. Like I was going to farmers market already, selling these glass jewelry marbles. And I'm looking around at me, going, "How do all these people make money off these vegetables? It doesn't make sense to me." And like I had a really big garden, and I needed to make a living, so I brought that stuff to my table instead of the glass. And I could not believe how much easier it was to sell vegetables, because everybody knows what to do with them. You don't have to sell yourself as an artist or this image so much. I mean, there is marketing in vegetables, that's for sure. But so I sort of fell into it, and I did not know anything about what I was doing. I took a course at UW-Madison in market gardening. It was just a 3-day course, but that, like, showing me how to expand my operation, how to, you know, do large-scale irrigation, put things in rows, and less permaculture and more like, you know, row it out. But the first thing they say you do in permaculture is attain a yield. And that's what I was going for, attaining a yield on this farm. And it just snowballed from there into a pretty big thing. I had heard about CSAs. And
Remind me again, the acres you're saying snowballing from glass blowing permaculture into production ag. Can you put a little number on your acreage?
Oh, yeah, probably like 1/8 of an acre of vegetables. And then within 2 years, we were using all 3 acres of usable land on my farm. And 7 years since the beginning now, we're up to 10.5 acres of vegetables.
So, you have 10.5 acres in production?
Yes.
Take that, hippie haters. Home
yeah.
scale from...
So, you know, yeah, I mean, it's possible. It has been difficult to make a living at it, but that's pretty much, I think, my own fault. Just, like I said, I fell into it. So, like, what I always tell people to do if they're really looking into this as a career is to go work on other farms and see how everybody else is doing it and get as much education and actual, physical activity in, you know, this as you can. Because, like, I did the exact opposite. I made every rookie mistake along the way that I probably could. And then, you know, you're young, and young males have this problem where they have all these big ideas and they go for them. And I did. I tried everything. It wasn't easy. I found that retail sales were the best for me, and farmers markets in Chicago area. I like the CSA thing, and it really helped me get started. But I'm mostly running it on my own right now, and the logistics of talking to all these CSA members, responding to them, making a newsletter, and all that, it's way too much for me. I love the simplicity of going to farmers market and bringing what I have and selling out, knowing that that works. So I'm getting to the point now where I finally figured out what I'm really good at growing and what I have the equipment to do and what sells really well for me. And it's starting to work out now. I'm not quite over the hump yet, but I think next year I probably will be. I've been saying that for a few years, but I see it now. I see the light. So that's why we really got into mushrooms. Like, when I first started, I was like, yeah, I'm going to grow purple broccoli and Romanesco and all these crazy things. And I realized that everybody knows what to do with that. especially in my Midwest meat and potatoes area. And so I found that staple crops were the best to bring people into the booth. And then we have a variety of other things. So, like, now we're growing a lot of different winter storage radishes, and I was bringing all these black Spanish radishes and beauty heart, like watermelon radishes, and huge radishes to market that are, like, totally different than what people are used to. But because I have the staples at my booth, you know, they're coming in because they love celery and my lettuce mix. But then we talk to them about the different flavors of the radishes, and boom, those are all gone too. So there's something to be said about, like, hitting this medium ground where you can, you know, please everybody, but then also bring in your specialty things. And that's why I got into mushrooms so much, is it's so unique. People know mostly about mushrooms, and, you know, they love them already, but there's not many farmers doing it. So that has really helped us become unique. I also love lettuce mix. Yeah.
So this is really great. I mean, I'm learning so much about weaning people into weirdo vegetables. And, you know, one thing it sounds like is that your customer base is actively evolving, like, underneath your nose, and you're tracking their evolution and trying to match your, you know, desire to grow weird vegetables. There's an awesome study that was done by the Leopold Center in Iowa that talked about how many jobs would be created and how much wealth would be created if, instead of importing all of the vegetables from California, where, P.S., there's a huge effing drought, the Midwest were to grow its own damn vegetables, and how many hundreds of millions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of jobs just vegetable self-sufficiency would mean for the Midwest. And I wondered if you could reflect a little about that study and just about kind of how the local foods movement in the Midwest has changed and what the scene is kind of headed towards. And what, you know, and from the perspective of people who potentially moved to the coast and found themselves in an overpriced, rent too high, job too low situation and might consider going back to the Midwest to start a farm, which is, frankly, the great number of those kinds of people is who I kept hanging out with in when I was on that recent trip. I was like, wow. I'm meeting all these people that I used to know in Portland, Oregon, and Maine, and in Brooklyn. And anyway, I'm going to stop asking the question so you can answer it.
Yeah. Let me see if I can remember. Well, yeah, I agree. I have, you know, I've had lots of friends that went out west or out east, and they, you know, to live their lives, and then they're starting to come back. There's something about the heartland, you know, where everybody's got a big heart in the Midwest. I have seen the evolution of food around here for sure, I guess, in the last few years. I mean, it took us like 3 years of bringing oyster mushrooms to market before everybody just, like, caught on, and now it's just sold out. And you're right, yeah, like, I've seen these people evolve in their food. It's amazing the way, you know, like, it can catch on. And in this area, you know, like, everything trickles in from the West Coast, it seems like. And right now, local is actually, like, a buzzword around here, and people are really starting to talk about it and have meetings on local food. And, like, we were both at Cinsinnowa Mound the other day, and the sisters are actually talking about starting to grow all their food again, you know? And that's a conversation you hear a lot of people starting. Actually, just earlier today, I was at the Dubuque Rescue Mission in Dubuque, Iowa, talking to Ashley Nysis, and she is the
who is, like, an angel person.
She's like an angel. You're right. Yeah, and she's, like, leading this this movement in Dubuque to feed not only the hungry, but to just spread the knowledge of local food all over this area. It's just amazing what they're up to there, and it's just a little incubator. Like, you know, you hear about everything happening on the West Coast and how they're got food growing in the cities on the rooftops, and those conversations are just starting here. So, like, to get in on the ground floor of this, I mean, you know, somebody like me, who I just fell into this, is I was told earlier today I'm an expert. And, you know, it never dawned on me. You know, in my wildest dreams, I would be an extra of vegetable farming. I just love what, you know, I'm doing here. But there's opportunities around this area just because it's not big yet. It's just starting, you know. It's great.
Boom, get in on the ground floor.
Yeah. Come on to the Midwest and let's grow some food because we need it. We do not need vegetables trucked thousands of miles, you know, and there is something very special about frosted vegetables too. Like, if you have a carrot that got a frost on it before it was harvested in the Midwest, that thing is sweet. You know, like Elliot Coleman from the Hoop House in the Middle of Winter, sweet. And, you know, you get a carrot shipped from California, and it was warm the whole time. That thing is just the regular carrot. And the same thing goes for cabbage and kohlrabi and radishes and beets. They all just get better. And I don't think that has caught on yet, how special Midwest vegetables are.
Well, and, you know, and then also because of the glaciation, I mean, you guys, I was in that produce section of the Dubuque Food Co-op and, you know, checking all the babies out and really just noticing a really high, you know, that kind of like mineral quality that vegetables get. And one
right.
thing I've been learning a lot about in California is the depletion, the mineral depletion of the land that's just, you know, lettuce, and a lot of irrigated water. And a lot of, you know, input, mm-hmm. such that the land itself has been mistreated and is not going to produce that same beautiful mineral quality in the vegetables.
Right. Yeah, they're wearing it out. And
anyway,
well, it is special.
I sometimes go off on these tangents, and then there I am on the end of a tangent, forgetting
yeah,
what we're talking about.
I understand.
Do you have any other recommendations for people who are thinking about rejoining the Midwestern Food Revolution, or comments that you want to get in before we end our interview?
Well, experience, you know, getting some experience is number one, as I stated before. I don't know if I could definitely say there was any special niche around here, except to just get into a really good farmer's market and to display yourself well. I see so many farmers that come to the markets in the Chicago area dirty, with dirty produce and, you know, old crates as their displays, and it just kind of looks icky, you know, and they're not doing well. I see them sitting there not selling their food. And if you want to sell some food, make it look clean. Like, people come to my booth and they're like, whoa, you have the most beautiful stand here at Farmer's Market. Like, that's a normal thing I hear at my booth. They're like, you have the cleanest produce I have seen. And I don't think I'm really doing too much. I'm not going overboard. We just, you know, come with a nice, clean display and clean food, and we keep it that way, you know. So, you know, marketing yourself. I mean, it's not like marketing art, but it is special to market vegetables. So, get into it. you know.
Well, you heard it here first. Wait a minute, he's got some more comments.
Oh, I'm good. You know, like. I can't say enough about how much of a struggle it was to get to this point. And, you know, dig your heels in deep and make it work, because there's something big going on here in vegetable farming and in local food production in general. So if you can dig your heels in deep, I think it's going to work, you know, for anybody who can has a green thumb. So it's been a pleasure talking to you today, for real. I really appreciate being on the radio.
It's a huge pleasure talking to you.
Yeah.
And I hope that we continue the conversation across these big distances, and I hope that next time we talk, there's 6 or 7 other young greenhorns in your 100-mile zone there.
I hope so. You know, maybe I'll help train them. Send them my way. Yeehaw. I'm not afraid of the competition.
Pick them out for apprenticeships. Tree
All right.
of Life Farm. And everybody else, listen. We've got a lot of big stuff coming up here in Greenhorn's world. We've got the almanac coming again. We have a deadline in February for almanac submissions. We have a bunch of new music up now. The Grange Future album is live on Etsy. We have market sales going at the Boston Public Market all the way through Christmas, selling the goods that we ship by sailboat from Maine. We're selling merchandise. We have beautiful new organic long-sleeve T-shirts with seeds on them, and they're really nice gifts that you could give or tell someone else to give it to you because they probably don't know how to give you a good gift. And frankly, Greenhorns has to raise some money, and we are selling stuff. So clickety-clack, do your holiday shopping while there's some jangle in your agrarian pocket to support your agrarian cultural and media organization called the Greenhorns. Thank you, everybody. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Have you listened to A Taste of the Past? It's a show devoted to connecting our current food world with its storied past. Host and culinary historian Linda Palacio welcomes chefs, scientists, authors, scholars, and revolutionaries into the studio to discuss food culture and history from around the globe.
Have you seen the culture of food change over the past 25, 30
years? Incredible. It's been incredible.
Linda covers content ranging from the history of black chefs in the White House to behavioral psychology and the evolution of Italian food in America. You can listen to A Taste of the Past anytime on heritageradionetwork.org or on iTunes and Stitcher.